Welcome to the Holden Village version of the Donahue program. The purpose of this hour is to elicit, I believe, statements. I have seen kinds of comments. It is intended to be a conversation period for us to exchange views, as they say in Washington, or do even better than that and exchange wisdom. This is the form on God sets the solitary in families.
Yeah, thank you.
That's what we're talking about tonight. We have all been in families. We have all participated in family life. Nobody, I take it here, was abandoned at an early age. And tonight, Ron Jacobson, who is a colleague in Lutheran Social Service activity, is with me because he knows a lot about families. The approach we want to use, as God sets the solitary in families, is through the eyes and the experience of children. We've all been children in families, true, and we probably all have had experience of having had children in families. So that's the context. We want to talk about positive aspects of family life, but we'd like to use Ryan's expertise in the children's view. They go at this from the point of view of where the kids are in viewing families and controlling parents. I think it was you that said yesterday, insanity is hereditary. We catch it from our children.
Actually, I think it was Sam Levinson, but Norm had the...
Norm said it. Okay. How would you like to help us get this set up, Ron, for some comments?
Well, if I could tell a couple of stories, because that's what we do with children. Actually, I take the point of view of a child, because my family claims I've never grown up.
And that's perfectly all right.
Three questions you kind of tend to hate to ask anybody these days or whatever. I guess, is that, how's the wife? How are the kids? And how's the job? Because you really don't know what kind of answer you're going to get. But I still encourage people to answer it, to ask it, and then to kind of listen sensitively for what kind of response you will get. I think we often underestimate kids. We underestimate what they're capable of, and we underestimate what we're capable of in terms of dealing with kids. One of my favorite little stories is about the youngster who had a school assignment, and that was to write an autobiographical essay. And so he came home, all prepared to do his homework, and came into the front door and said, Mama, where did I come from? Well, his mother, fearing this question, although not at quite this early age, quickly jumped into her kind of pattern response and said, "The stork brought you, my dear." And the youngster felt, well, that wasn't really going to help him much in terms of his assignment. So he said, "Well, Mommy, where did you come from?" And the mother, feeling that she was being pressed, answered rather quickly, "The stork brought me also, my dear." But Ken thought he'd take one more crack at it, and so, "Oh, Mommy, where did Grandma come from?" And the mother, feeling that her ideological ground was being really challenged, felt that she had to be very firm, said, "Well, a stork brought her also, and let's have that be the end of it." So the kid went down to his room and began his essay. "There have been no natural births in our family for three generations."
It's a wise child.
I think sometimes we underestimate the wisdom of our kids. A friend of mine, Jim Merrill, who is the director of Lutheran Social Services in North Dakota, gives a very interesting speech called, "Have You Ever Stepped on a Butterfly?" And he starts us off with talking about a scene from a cathedral film on stewardship a number of years ago, in which there's this very busy street scene. And coming down this street in a southerly direction was a youngster, armload of books and things from school. As he's heading down the street, he comes to an intersection. Well, in a north-going direction comes a fellow who is a busy businessman, heading for some appointment or need a plane or something like that. And he was going at quite a rapid pace. And in the middle of an intersection, the two collide. And the kid falls, and the books and the papers go all over the place. And you think, for a minute, that son of a gun just isn't going to stop. And the man checks himself in mid-stride. He looks at his watch and turns around, kneels down, and begins to help the kid sort, pick up his papers. And the kid looks at him, and it's sort of a, that's sort of an extraordinary event for a youngster. Here's this kid, eyeball to eyeball with an adult. Now that doesn't often happen with children, because usually they're looking up at us. And struck by this apparently, or by the man's helpfulness, or whatever, raised, asked the question, are you God? Well, that's kind of a compliment to the adult. And it's kind of representative, I think, of sometimes the view that kids have of us, and in a way, what we have as adults to give to children in modeling. There's another story of another kid with a school assignment who had been given this assignment along with all of his classmates to come back the next day with an original drawing that is all your own. And the kid was just very terrified about this assignment because he had no artistic ability. He couldn't even draw reasonable stick figures. And so he went home with a great deal of apprehension, kind of went into the house and sort of dawdled through his meal, didn't eat much, kind of absentmindedly went upstairs after meal, and all of a sudden had this flash of a brilliant idea. He was going to draw a picture of the sun very close up. So he got this sheet of white paper, and he got an orange crayon, and he took an orange, up and down, back and forth across. He covered the whole picture, or the whole paper, with orange. The sun, very close up. He was very excited about this. He ran downstairs, showed his mother. Well, she had all kinds of things going on. The laundry was due, and the baby's diapers needed changing. She didn't really have too much time to pay attention to the answer, but never mind, he was all excited about this. So the next day, trots out to school, assignment under his arm, and he wants to tell his classmates about this great idea he had. Well, they had their own assignments, and they didn't pay too much attention. Oh, that's all right. He got to school and ready to show it to the teacher, because surely this teacher had given him the assignment, she would appreciate his creativity. So the teacher called for the assignment, despite the fact that the kid sat somewhere near the back of the room, he was one of the first up to present the drawing of the sun to his teacher. The teacher looked at it and said, what's the meaning of this? What is the meaning of this? I told you to have an original creative drawing. I'll tell you what, your assignment tomorrow is to come back with two drawings or bring your parents. The teacher put the kid down in front of the whole class. And the story says that that night, a young child committed suicide. I don't know if the story is true or not, but it certainly has the possibility of that. Because one of the things I think that we sometimes forget as adults is the kind of power we have to mold, and to build, and to lift up. Our problem in our society oftentimes is we teach from the negative. One of the things that my wife and I know from home and village here is kids are nurtured. And people like the little kids, and they relate to the little kids, and they kind of lift them up. But this isn't the way it is in the supermarkets. It isn't the way it is in many of our homes. So I guess I'd just like to use those few examples to give us a basis on which to talk about what we can and what the possibilities are in terms of dealing with our kids and our families.
I think it would be useful, Ron, if you'd tell us once again what the title is and the expertise that you have in running a particular kind of home for children.
I'm the director of an institution the other side of the mountains here called Luther Child Center. We're a mental health center for children. We've dealt with children in residence programs for some 80 years. Well, we close that program down the summer. We advocate very strongly for children. We start off with the basis of a family comes in with a problem. We deal with the problem with a focus on a child. And we are very strong in dealing with and advocating for children who have been sexually abused. So our focus is children. And the care and treatment of children and the training of parents in terms of dealing with children with severe problems. Okay, thank you.
Please.
Who has in your estimation, has the greatest problems, the kids or the parents? Or which is harder to mold or to change or deal with?
If we can work with parents, we have much, much higher success of helping children. The most difficult time we have in terms of having or helping children is when we can't capture the attention of the parents. A couple of the programs that we do, we use as the basis of treatment social learning theory, which is the assumption that much of behavior is learned. And so if a child or a person can be taught certain behaviors, you can correct those behaviors also through a teaching process.
That says something like the usual line that child abusers have been abused child and children. That's the way they've learned to be abused. Is that right?
That's the statistical model says that yes, in most instances that is correct.
See, there's a sense in which when you look at negative issues in families, especially where you deal with children, and we have LSS, Lutheran Social Services of Illinois, has two such residence programs for disturbed adolescents. You get the idea that parents, you don't appreciate children. It's not only gross neglect, but there is a lack of appreciation in the first place, a lack of understanding, and just a sort of unwillingness to accept a gift that God has given. There's a kind of a secularity that underlies a lot of this. We're putting a pious title like God sets the solitary in families, like we have. Try to put it in very positive terms, but that's not necessarily the way it's seen. Ruth, you wanted to say something.
I just wanted to pick up on that because I really think that a tremendously important aspect of our culture, that there is somehow in our society we have in a very real way rejected our children. I think it's borne out by the way in which we have accepted abortions. I think that the low priority of education in many communities, that there's a kind of a hatred toward our children, and I think that coupled with it is a real fear about parenting, a sense of inadequacy. One of the things that surprises me is that we haven't addressed that. I think that we've been super cautious, and as the church even, in aggressively addressing that in our society. I know a number of years ago, I think it was like 15 years ago now, the Franciscans had a series of commercials that were run on television that had to do with family relations. When someone doesn't like himself, that's when he needs your love. That sort of thing, that kind of refrain, and it illustrated a number of situations where you could recognize where someone was very angry or upset or about something or struggling up, and the awareness was that they don't like themselves. You know, it isn't that just that they're upset with you, but there's something more basic than that. And I was so pleased to see it, but I've seen almost none of it in recent years. And it seems to me that would be an educational tool that is available to us with the media that we perhaps aren't utilizing as much as we should.
I was struck in your story that, in thinking what Ruth just been saying, when the man knocked the kid down and spilled the books, he looked at his watch and then helped the kid. It's significant, that watch business sticks in my mind is significant because I think a lot of this has to do with time. So living in the town that I live in, and there are probably half the men in that town commute into the city. I get on the train at 6:40, which means that so that they can get into the city early, which means that they probably get up at least an hour before that. They catch the 5:05 train home from the city, which means that they don't arrive in Geneva until 6:10, 6:15, probably don't get home until 6:30. They've spent an enormous amount of time and energy out of any kind of sensible reach of any of their children. The kids go to school right there. And there isn't very much constructive time left, to spend with the child. That may be related to what you said. Elmer, yeah, please.
It's always charming to me that we always talk about middle-class suburban children who are the minority of the world. And keeping with our theme, I wonder if the question is the church I've been facing is it a right to have a child? Should everyone who gets married have children? Especially in this country, when every child here uses up so much resources of the world in comparison to all the others. It seems to me some of the hatred comes from people who, without knowing what it's about, and I do believe that people in this country, some people in this country should hate children, come somehow either out of an obligation, one that I think the church is causing, that if you get married, there's something wrong with you if you don't have children right away. I think out of a biblicism, out of the Old Testament, that says, be fruitful and multiply, and everybody's going to, take that little of themselves. Jesus lived with, apparently, a lot of single people. He himself was a single person, did not have any children, was the child of God. I'd like to see the church face up to that, because I think we're getting down at the roots of what we're about.
Well, you're dangerously close to sanctioning something that's true in a socialist society. In China, you can't have but two children without severe penalties. Taxes, for instance, and other kinds of privileges.
Another aspect of what Elmer's saying is that that we see, it's not stated so overtly, but we see people who view the children that they have as impediments to their good life.
They were helpers on the farm. They're not living on the farm anymore. You get a babysitter.
There's the other side of that same coin, because I think our tendency, because we still see so much of it, is to maybe downgrade parents or complain about parents in terms of treating children. There are parents that are marvelous parents. There are people who, we see a lot of people who take children in foster care. And so that good parenting is just, it's like an art form. It's like molding something beautiful, and it is really something wonderful to behold.
Is it proper to judge parenthood by the results of the children's social lives and attitudes toward life?
No, I certainly.
I mean, there ought to be some criteria.
Yeah. No, I don't think I hardly think that's fair. I guess it's. I've looked at it this week from the other side. We have a son that's here, and several people come and say, "Oh, what a wonderful son you have!" And I kind of back off and afraid in a way. Say, "Well, I attribute that to a recessive gene." But I think what you say, there is a sense of blaming. Now there are parents actually who ought to be blamed. There are parents who do a very destructive job of raising children, and are very destructive relative to how they treat their children. And some of them ought to be thrown in jail. But I don't think we ought to just broadly assign blame if things don't happen in the beautiful way.
You're talking about case-by-case kinds of decisions rather than a standard set of criteria? Donald raised a question about third world children. Kind of asking us to think about children other than those that we see right around us. Although I suspect that you don't have to go very far into urban America, Washington, D.C., Cabrini Green in Chicago, and you will meet third world children, or something very close to that.
Parish I belong to in Chicago, the mothers talked about daughters making it to age 7 without being raped.
Are these third world children you're speaking of? Or third, whatever you call it?
Well, no. I just mentioned with Chicago, if you call it third world.
Well, you know, I don't know.
I don't know. The labels, I don't know, but I just know they're there.
Third world usually refers to that portion of the world which is unaligned. People in our segment would call it underdeveloped or developing. And it means mostly, I think, people who don't belong to either the Western, the Northern Hemisphere, Western industrialized capitalist community or the socialist nation. And I think it's a very loose kind of thing, but it talks about the continents of Africa, Latin America, Asia, and I think probably you could put China into that. Certainly India. And I suspect now that we wind up talking the way we talk, not because we have such a dull social conscience, but because we don't know very much about those places in the first place. And secondly, the pressures or the interests, the concerns are much closer. When you think of children as the extension of our own families, it's pretty hard to reach very far from our own memories and our own experience. Seems to me.
I kind of take a little bit in the sense of to try and put a positive construct on it, that one of the things that we encounter with a lot of parents is real lack of knowledge, a lack of knowing how to be affirming, reliance on discipline as opposed to positive kind of things. That struck by John Watkins this afternoon, talking about a model of affirmation, and what was that the term that you used, John?
The positive reciprocity.
Yes, the reciprocity. Yes, which I think is a tool that we ought to be teaching much more broadly in terms of how
there, were some of us who weren't in that session. I think we ought to hear what positive reciprocity means. What does that signify?
Not quite sure how to capsulize the whole thing. Well, yes, I am. Because the point began with Confucius having been asked what one word would be, a word that would represent how people, a principle under which people should live their lives. And he said, replied that it would be reciprocity. And he defined that as do not treat others as you do not want to be treated. And of course, then Christ stated in the positive. And what happens in terms of what Ron is sharing here, I think, is that we often find ourselves in a position where unpleasant things, hurtful things happen to us, and we have that tendency to give back in kind and establish a relationship that where everybody is doing unkind things to everybody else. And when I can make that choice, that even though I am being hurt in my own attitude, I can be positive, I can be positive in my behavior, and perhaps others will change their response to me as a result. But it begins with us. So does that represent, Ron, what you were thinking of?
Yes. It's looking at, particularly to do with children, it's looking at children as co-equal recipients of the human experience, I think, where we often tend to, in our society, in a litigated sense, think of children relative to property rights, sort of who gets the house, who gets the car, who gets the kids, kind of thing. And what you described this afternoon kind of puts a different context to that, I think. It more humanizes children.
Maybe this is straying from the topic a little bit, but what's your experience with children of single parents or children who have step-sisters or brothers?
I would say that that again depends upon the parent, as a parent. There are some handicaps, but I don't think they're anything you overcome relative to role models. They say the male role model, so the child can pick up those up in other places that you can see single parents, I think, coping very well with children in a very gentle, kindly way.
I think there's a phenomenon that we've been experiencing over the last number of years as we've been having what is called the disintegration of the family, if you will. Obviously, your point is a good one, that we, when we talk about the family, it's really a matter of what kind of configuration should we talk about. We can't really talk about what was the basic family before, because that's not there. It's there for some. I was fortunate to grow up in that. My wife grew up in that. But on the other hand, for both my wife and myself, it's a second marriage. We have that as a consideration. We have our child, but you know, I'm also a stepfather to her children. And so, you know, what kind of a family are you dealing with there? There's another point I was going to make, though. Darn it, slipped me.
The question over here was, do children of single parents have more problems,
right,
generally speaking, than others? In other words, you come from a two-parent family. And I wonder whether that generalization holds up.
I'm wondering about. I think there is another kind of family that is emerging. And it isn't necessarily blood relationship by any means. But we have witnessed over the years now the evolution of what has been known as support groups. And these support groups may be in support of a problem of alcoholism and dealing with that. It may be a support group of a different kind, but it's almost that the support group has come out as a response to the absence of closeness and sharing and intimacy within the family. And we now need to get together with others of our own kind, whatever that is, to share that way. I'd just like to get some other views if others have observed that. But the group has come out now in place of the family.
There are groups that are substituting for what once were family functions, especially
right,
if you had lots of relatives living around. Ruth, you had a comment.
That is an exciting development to me too. I have a friend in Seattle who is a Russian lady and a single parent, and speaks English very brokenly and has had much difficulty over the years. But I've gotten to know her quite well during the last year and a half, and she has gone through crisis after crisis after crisis within the time I've known her. And she told me this thing. She said, you know, in her broken way, she said, you know, I was always so afraid being a parent by myself and not having a father for my daughter, for Rosa. But she said, God has taken care of me. He's given me friends at every point of the way. And now, she said, my friends care more for me and take better care of me than my family ever did. She'd experienced a lot of rejection from her immediate family. And it's just a whole discovery of her. And for her, it's the hand of God putting her in the family of the world. And that is a thrilling thing to me, because I think that's what the world needs now. that's the sense that we are one family. It's wonderful to see.
Mm-hmm. Bill had a comment, then Elmer.
Yeah, just a brief one. Yeah, I don't know if support groups are moving in where there's absence. That may be the case. I think they are there as supplement, where they're in other situations is good communication within certain families, but for certain kinds of sharing, exploring, support, there is the supplement. So perhaps in the absence for some, but for others as supplement.
Thank you, Bill.
I think my wife here, one of the things she mentioned, because this was of great interest to her, was our experience at Holden. We've been coming here for 21 years and how many times. Our kids found surrogate parents here. As soon as they got a little older, we agreed with them. We would eat with them on Tuesday and Thursday evenings, sure they were in the village. And they did a lot of stuff for themselves, but often.
Has there been a change, it seems to me there has, in the sense that when we were kids, and I'm speaking of 75, 80-year-olds, our parents had their problems and they seemed to solve them in our church, or nobody else seemed to care about how they were solved. And now we have psychiatrists and psychologists, and we have rap sessions on these sorts of things, and we talk about the ins and the outs and the ifs and the and all the rest of it. We didn't do those things. I don't believe, I've never heard of a five-year-old having to have a shrink, for example, when I was a kid.
Like our grandchildren.
Is there a swing toward complicating life because we use our brains more completely than we used to?
What's the change and what's the reason for the change? John, what do you think?
I think for me, one of the major shifts has been that in the years that you're speaking of, and those in between here, we have moved from a time where so much of our time, or others' time, was occupied with a sense of purpose, a sense of meaning. They had to do things.
Yes.
Their time was totally occupied. Yeah. They didn't have time to think, I guess, it's sort of that a mother of a dozen children never gets sick. She never gets the flu. She doesn't have time for it. And so she's really occupied. And what we're seeing here, I think, is more of a trend because we have more time, leisure time. A figure that I heard recently on television was that the typical family spends 49 hours a week in front of the television set. That's more time than we're spending at work. And I think that's a very significant comparison.
Put a date on that. Help us to understand when do you guess that happens?
When do I think it happens?
Things aren't like they used to be. Since when aren't they like they used to be? The age of television is one. But what would be your guess as to a time?
I would say things are never like they used to be.
Well, that's true.
They never have, and they never have been like they used to be. I think we're in a, this is a constantly changing. But television is a big factor, and television is a great teacher, and mostly what it teaches us is how to be violent.
All television is education television. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's a neat point, too, in that companies will spend thousands, millions of dollars for just a matter of 30 seconds or 60 seconds or whatever. And that same 30 seconds can be used and just as persuasive when it's showing pictures of what's happening in El Salvador or Vietnam, or whether it's showing the A-Team or whatever else. It's the same persuasive quality, whether it's selling a product or selling an idea.
I guess that about 1955 to 1960 is when this began to take place. Mickey Mouse Club, 19 early 50s, Captain Kangaroo. Comment over here and then back to Elmer, please.
Well, I see a new problem arising in the family, and that's the recent advent of daycare centers. They're really relatively new, and we haven't seen the impact of that. I don't know what session I attended, maybe it was yours, where you said that the meaningful interfacing we have with our children is something like 14 minutes a day on average. And of that, I think it was something like 8 minutes was used up in just good morning and wash your teeth and whatever, nothing of substance. With daycare, there's even probably less involved, and someone else is raising your child, really.
And this has other things ancillary to that. Working parents, it causes need for daycare.
I think it's related to our materialistic.
Yes.
Well, preferences. In some cases, survival.
Well,
city, inner city,
yes and no. Yes and no. Of the people I see, and my viewpoint is highly limited to my community, I see mainly women working to get the better things in life because dad doesn't make enough money. I find the single mother who's doing the same thing, but why is she single? Partly by choice. You know, I don't like that guy anymore, or he doesn't like me anymore. It's not a matter of one diet or the other, percentage-wise.
Some of it, though, is the cost of college sometimes, not $15,000 a year. If you have a person's going to be a freshman in college and still have some younger kids, it's almost a thing of survival that both have to work.
That's true, too.
So,
but it really boils down to, doesn't it, love?
Well, there are several reasons for that phenomenon. Albert, did you have one to add to this?
My own family, my brothers and I think World War II did have a piece for them, too. It broke them out of a whole pattern, took them to different parts of the world. To be seeing things and doing things I think they never would have done. And that was pre-television mostly. I think that was another job.
Mobility. That's one that I would put into it. Mobility. The way my neighbors move. And what that means is that people don't have the settled life nor the reputation. And the consensus that reputation and settledness gives to a community is broken. We're much more anonymous because we move. People don't know our families. We don't know our roots and this kind of thing. I think that makes a difference to this whole question.
Technology.
Which one?
Technology in general, and the impact that has on the sense of security, whatever that would be, with what you do to make money, to live with.
I think that's in a broader context that is a factor. If you listen to people who study systems, who are futurists, they will say that we've moved from an either or to a both and kind of environment. We've moved from the kind of environment where the leader is the one who used to have the answer, and now it's the one who knows how to ask the questions rather than having the answer. I mean, there has been a real technological shift that shows up in a lot of places. Another that I picked up out of that I'm kind of watching some futurists reading it that we see in a number of big cities the group of people that we call street kids, mm-hmm. and we've talked about it in terms of doing something and kind of licking that frog, and anybody who is looking at that closely is saying we are not going to lick that problem. That group of kids that we are calling street kids is going to develop into a large subculture. And so we'll have the subculture of the real bright techies on one side, the kids are the computer wizards and that sort of thing, and we'll have this large subculture of street kids on the other hand. That's something that's coming.
So when you ask, are things like they used to be, and the answer first off is, well, they never were. But look at the number of answers we can apply to that business of change. And in almost, I think it's Alan Toffler in one of the first books, Future Shock, who has that graph that shows what's been happening since 1900. And almost everything has gone that way and off the map. And consumption, patterns of consumption, and almost anything you've mentioned. We've been living in an age not only of violence, but of fantastically violent change. The velocity of social change has been just stupendous. Kenneth Boulding said something to the effect that the world that he was born into resembled the world of Julius Caesar in 1900. And that's within the memory of my father. It's a memory within the memory of a lot of people. These kinds of changes have been taking place. And we hardly We have become so accustomed to that phenomenon of rapid change that we hardly notice it until somebody asks a question like the one that was just asked.
Right. There's an interesting counterbalance to that that's kind of taking place, and that's the way that seeking of more simple answers in a more complex society, and that's a kind of a naive seeking. The way we see that a little bit in our limited view of human kids is we actually are seeing a kind of a rising disproportionate tide of child abuse amongst people who have more fundamentalist kind of religious beliefs. The spare the rod, spoil the child is such a misunderstood, misinterpreted kind of piece of scripture.
That's interesting because the pedagogy of Christian schools in the area that we live in is not spare the rod and spoil the child at all. Or it is that spare the rod and spoil the child. Corporal punishment in Christian schools is very strong doctrine.
And I will say this as a non-theologian, but work in an institution where corporal punishment is something you just don't do. You don't use violence on a child. And the interpretation that I like best by Marie Fortune, who is a Methodist minister in Seattle area, who's written a little bit on the area of family violence, defines the rod as the shepherd's rod. And the shepherd did not beat the sheep to line them up or get them to go in the right direction. The rod was a guiding tool, and it's not a bludgeon. And so that the spare the rod, spoil the child is spare the guidance. But it doesn't mean spare the whip.
Anybody here teach parenting? The term has been used a number of times, and I just was curious to know what I think.
Isn't the loss of parenting aimed at problems that arise rather than teaching from day one of the child?
When you get to this question of parenting, what are the elements in that kind of course, and can it be taught? John, first and back here.
Well, to answer your question directly, I have taught both, and I have both been trained in the Parent Effectiveness Training Program.
That's PET.
PET, right. And I got interested in it simply because to me that was the best communication program that I'd come across, and it was outside my actual field. There was that need, and my intent next week has been to share some of that kind of thing. But beyond that, I don't know if you would consider that parenting. Yes.
It's kind of broad. Yeah. What?
I've taken several different approaches.
To say that, make your messages to your children very clear. As an example, you have a youngster playing over here, making a lot of racket or doing something that's unacceptable. And our tendency is to say, Mary, will you behave? Well, the kid's behaving all over the place. I mean, that's, you have to be a little more specific than that.
Yes, even something like I'm trying to read isn't really clear. It's being the same thing as like done.
Could we go back a minute to talk recently here of child care centers? Now, we had the pleasant experience of visiting China a couple of years ago, and I was quite impressed with the advancement in their civilization, where a factory will take the children of the workers and provide all the facilities needed to care for them while the worker is at work. And I thought that was a marvelous thing, because our daughter, for example, has to find babysitters and all that problem to solve, whereas in China it's automatically taken care of. The preschool and the school and the older children have a place to be under care and direction while the parent is gainfully employed. And we could use some of that in this country. We're a little bit backward in that area, in my opinion. And they've had a civilization, despite its problems, that's been going on for centuries. And I think a child care center is a good idea. I'd like to understand if any of you others have comments on that score.
John, you have your hand up.
Okay, yeah, there's a wonderful tape, or a couple tapes out by a gentleman by the name of Massey, who talks about who you are is where you were when. And what he's talking about in that videotape, or the film, is that where you are from basically from the age of 10 up into the teens and so forth, you are at that point being value programmed. In other words, that's where your values get set as to what you believe in, what you find acceptable, what's right, and where you make those kinds of judgments. And I think it really begins a little bit before that, maybe somewhere around age 6 or 7, our values are really getting formed. And I kind of wonder if it's regardless of the kind of physical care that a child is being given, he is at the same time being given value training, whether we want it or not. And I think it's really unfortunate simply because there is a building that has people working in it that will take care of kids and meet their physical needs. I don't know if it's really wise to entrust our child to anybody's values who happens to be in that building.
That's the bad end of it. I've seen these Chinese day school centers, and I share your admiration for them. It depends, doesn't it, on what circumstance. The daycare centers, the 9 daycare centers in the inner city that Lutheran Social Services of Illinois runs in Chicago, are doing something about that value business. But these values are the shared values, I think, of a lot of the people who send their children there. You can do it the other way, you know, and it's been said about the socialist society, they're only being taught socialist values and so on. But I'm not so sure. I mean, I think sometimes we can make a judgment at either end and make a mistake about it. There's a comment back here, and then we have to be respectful of comments. Yeah,
I
please.
I think this has something to do with it. I'm not absolutely sure. But why is it that more parents nowadays are caring less about if their children learn or not in school?
Well, so, you know, that may be related to this. There's a value that we place upon the education of children. You look at some school systems and the tax problems that people are having, you begin to wonder whether we can afford to educate our children. Does it have a high enough value?
Well, the reason I say this is my wife is a kindergarten teacher for 30 years, and this last year was the worst year she's had in 30 years, and the reason for it is she had 2 fairly large classes. She had about 52 altogether. And out of those 52, only about 8 or 10 of them had parents that would back them up and try to teach them something. The others could care less if they had the school or not.
See, this is
they wanted to go to
TV,
watch TV, and that's it. They didn't want to go to school. They didn't want to learn anything. You'd tell them one thing one day, they'd go home, they'd come back, she'd have to tell them all over again, the same thing you did the day before. They will not learn, they will not retain, the parents will not cooperate at all, they wouldn't even come in for conferences.
She's not
had an awful time to stress.
It's not only a dissonance in the
so
in the kind
80%
of
the parents in her particular class would not back her up.
Yeah. One more comment, then we must quit for compliment. Were you going to say something on this?
No, it's not right.
As is true of most of these forums, we come to no particular conclusion at the end. There isn't any kind of summary that we can give, except the summary that probably all of us ought to paste in our hats, and that is that everything is more complicated than it seems to most people.